Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for attending today's Lunch and Learn at AU Central and for those of you who are online. We must inform you today that the Lunch and Learn presentation is being recorded and the presentation will be posted onto the Research Center website, and you can view that at a later date. It is now my pleasure to hand the microphone over to Dr. Cindy Ives to continue with today's presentation. Cindy?
Thanks, Alice. I hope everybody can hear me all right. Just let Alice know if you can't or if there's a problem through the chat box. Really delighted to be here today. Corinne Bossé, who's a learning designer in the Center for Learning Design and Development, is here with me in Athabasca. And Linda McLeod-Bondock, who is the coordinator of the Right Site, is in Calgary, joining us from Calgary. Mary Pringle, who is also with CLDD, is not here today but is very much part of this presentation. Our presentation today is a research presentation on assignment design for effective academic writing. There may be some confusion around the fact that we have also just recently sent out an all-staff invitation to a workshop on assignment design for effective academic writing. The presentation today is about the research that we did leading up to that workshop, and the workshop is on December the 6th. So I hope that there's not too much confusion. We won't deal as much in the workshop with the literature review, and we won't deal as much today with the actual practical applications, but we hope that you're interested in one or both of those activities. So just to begin, this is a part of the educational development activity that the Center for Learning Design and Development is responsible for at Athabasca, and we are delighted to work again with the Right Site and follow on our very successful work in the area of plagiarism last year and also at the Learning Services Conference with Linda. I'll just share with you today our objectives, that is this, our team, our objectives for what we'd like to accomplish by the end of this hour. We want to give you a working definition of what effective academic writing is. In fact, we started out thinking about assignment design for good writing and have decided instead to title our work Effective Academic Writing in order to be more precise about what we're looking for and designing support around, but also to be clear that good writing is a subjective way of describing the writing products that students are responsible for, whereas effective writing is writing that meets the standards of the course that have been set out in the guidelines, the marking guidelines, and so on. We're going to give you a selective literature review. And we've really only pulled out two aspects of the literature review that we've done leading up to our work in this area, partly because of time and partly because we think that the two areas that we've picked are the two most important. We would be delighted, however, in your feedback on that. We're going to explore how the design elements of rubrics and writing to learn assignments, those are the two high priority areas that we're going to talk to you about the literature review on, how they lead to effective writing practices. So we're going to show why effective writing is related to the use of rubrics and writing to learn assignments within Athabasca University courses, and not just Athabasca courses, but courses in general. So there's quite a lot of scholarship around rubrics, designing and using them, and quite a lot of scholarship around writing to learn. We're going to discuss just very briefly some principles and strategies that leads us into what will happen in the December 6th workshop, which is based in Edmonton. There are still a few seats for that workshop, so if you're interested, you can talk to us more and we'll give you the contact for registration. So Linda is going to get us started this morning with a description of what we mean by effective academic writing. Linda. Linda, go ahead, please.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, that's fine.
Great, thanks. I am not seeing the slides, so I'm going to kind of talk a bit about that. The first slide, what you should be seeing is the slide on what is effective writing. And the definition that you see there is the one that we use, that's the understanding that we use at the Write Site. And with good assignment design, really, I think that's one of the things that we're aiming for. And what I want to emphasize about this definition is that I think what most faculty aim for in good academic writing or effective academic writing goes beyond the grammar and punctuation concerns, although that is a part of good writing. I think most people would agree, though, that one of the most important parts of academic writing has to do with the ability to express critical thinking and report effectively on research in a way that adheres to writing conventions and specifically writing conventions of particular disciplines. And that's really what that last part of the definition is about, that business about sound application of critical thinking, research, etc. And today, when we talk a little bit more about the literature on assignment design approaches, I will be focusing, and as Kareen will be, on that particular piece of academic writing, the critical thinking and the learning. Okay, go ahead, Cindy.
So this slide starts with what effective academic writing is not, and then emphasizes what we think it is, what the literature says it is, what the writing, what the Write Site uses as basic principles for what we're trying to get students to do in their effective writing. So effective writing is not about a single set of standards. It depends on the discipline. It depends on the level. It's related to the course that the student happens to be in. And as Linda already said, effective academic writing is not just writing that is grammatically correct or structurally correct. It has a number of other characteristics, some of which are listed on the other side of the table. So writing that is clear, coherent, and that demonstrates a real understanding of the content, the subject matter. Of course, grammatical, organizational, and disciplinary conventions and standards are important, but they are only a piece of effective academic writing. And it is completely dependent on the stage of development of the writer, the level of the course, and of the reader. So your expectations in a first-year course or second-year course are naturally going to be quite different than they would be in a final course, a graduating year course, or a graduate course. And clearly, writing where the form and content work together, not just to create meaning, but to demonstrate understanding and conceptual understanding, grasp of content, grasp of convention, and meeting a set of criteria and standards. Kareen's now going to talk about the rubrics.
Hi. One of the reasons why we focused on rubric was kind of to ground this notion that writing across the disciplines, we all come from it from different approaches, but certainly from the student's point of view, one of the things that helped them the most, according to the literature, is to having some kind of guidelines in order to reach the expectations and the objectives that are set depending on the courses that you're dealing with. So one of the definitions that we used is based on Reddy and Andrade. They've done a review, basically, of the literature on rubrics used in the higher education context in particular. And what they've done is summarized definitions according to some of the key thinkers in the field. So what they came up with was a definition that was about the document that we use to articulate the expectations for an assignment, and by listing, and this is key, the criteria of what we think counts in a particular assignment, and also to describe the levels of quality from excellent to poor. And you might be interested, for those of you who want to know more about this, they do cite one of the key classic references on the rubric, which is Archer and others. And they wrote one of those seminal books in 2001 that was entitled Scoring Rubrics in the Classroom Using Performance Criteria for Assessing and Improving Student Performance. And pretty much if you do a literature review, on rubrics, you will almost see Archer and others being cited. And I even found the reference in one of the distance educational journal recently, so it is appropriate. If we go to the next slide, to go back to this notion of rubrics, and what exactly do we find in rubrics regardless of the approaches that you use, you will always find some kind of evaluation criteria, which tends to be the guidelines to assess what content is important. So as the subject matter expert in your discipline, whether it's sciences, social sciences, language and literature, the humanities. As a discipline expert, you know what type of contents you're looking for, and you would like to specify those content and criteria to your students. Then there's always going to be some kind of quality definition. And really what that is, it's a detailed explanation of what kind of skill the students will need to demonstrate, what kind of proficiency you want them to attain. And basically this is where you will typically say, this is a poor example of doing this, this is fair, this is good, this is excellent. In a nutshell, you want to let students know what you consider to be a good or a poor performance. And so it's really the distinction and the range of quality in terms of what you're assessing. And then the last component of a rubric is the scoring strategy or the standards. And really here, it's whatever kind of scale that you are comfortable using in your discipline to give this judgment about the actual product. So some will assign a letter, some will assign a grade. It really depends on your kind of your ease. One thing to know about the rubrics, it's that some people are very comfortable using them sort of in a holistic way, where they just have typically a chart or a little grid and just sort of like overall look at students' assignments and determine the quality and assigned some kind of judgment to it. And others will be way more analytical, and I will point this in some of the examples. By analytical, I mean that they will actually dissect each component of the assignments and assign a certain comment and feedback to students to sort of like help them throughout their assignment. If we go to the next slide, I just want to sum up a little bit what rubrics have been used for in the context of higher education in particular. They have been used for formative and summative purposes. And by that I mean some have see fit to use the rubrics to get some feedback about the student's progress in their journey throughout the course, and by tackling typically at the introductory level or at the beginning of a course, some kind of assignment, and they just want to know where the student's at. And some have used it for summative purposes in terms of like actually using the rubric to assess the final product of students. Rubrics can be used or be seen as developmental approach to writing. And that really goes in with the last point, which is, in a sense, what you do is you give the students a map to set clear expectations about how they're supposed to navigate their assignments. And this really is kind of tied to, from what the literature suggests and from the review, that the JOD and the company have conducted. It tends to increase students' performance according to their research and their survey of the literature. It also tends to focus students' attention in terms of like the performance of developing their arguments for specific assignments, because what it is, it's like it goes beyond professors or instructors saying to students to go off and write an essay or go off and write an assignment and expect them to do well. It actually points very clearly to students exactly what it is that they've been assessed against, and also to help them navigate as they're conducting their own writing pieces what it is that they should focus on when they write the assignment. So really what it is, it's guiding the students through the process of writing, and hopefully without being so much, you know, blinded by the amount of information that they have to go and sift through. If you go to the next slide, I just want to give you some quick examples, and some of these will be elaborated more during the workshop, and you'll have sort of a more concrete examples of rubrics for those of you who are interested. So as I was sort of like looking at some examples that might be appropriate, given that we are at Athabasca dealing with a range of disciplines from the sciences to the social sciences and the language, literature, etc., I thought that I would pull some examples across the disciplines and also to show you different contexts in terms of writing and how it has been used. If we want to contextualize rubrics beyond the sort of like academic looking at the language aspect, there has been some pretty creative use of them across the disciplines. And in one of the studies I was looking at and in TIA, they've been using the rubrics for interdisciplinary writing. And in that particular case, they were using students, I think it's out of the University of Miami, and they were actually engaged in all kinds of interdisciplinary writing courses. And really what that means is like a mix of social sciences courses, and students have to kind of use, I would say the equivalent at Athabasca would be kind of a maze courses. So they came at it from sort of the social sciences and cross-cultural background. And what the students were doing is because they all came for different academic, I guess, disciplines, the instructor felt that they needed to have some kind of common understanding to assess the writing pieces that were coming out from the students. So what they've done was to engage students in actually developing a rubric, and also having some clear guidelines in terms of like purpose for the writing, in terms of like you know, clarity of the arguments, all these things that we know is part of the piece of critical writing. And what that was, it was kind of used as a common instrument for all the students who were coming across these various disciplines to understand what it is that they were engaged in. And from what the authors were reporting, there has been increased satisfaction, not only from the instructor's point of view in terms of achieving a better quality of the writing, but from the students. And I think that was key, that the students themselves, who might have been skeptical at the beginning, were themselves engaged and reported a positive feedback of using a rubric as they were dealing with the different types of assignments. Again, this the rubric is not so much just to write sort of a noble academic essay, but it has been used as well for different purpose. For example, the one that I really like is from Blomel and Abbott. In their studies, what they've done, they actually use the rubric as a research piece within the pharmaceutical department. And that was a very interesting study because they were dealing both with the discipline, which is pharmacy, and they were dealing with those second year to fourth year doctoral students who were starting or advanced in their studies at the graduate level in terms of pharmacy. And what they've done is that they needed to improve and wanted to test a student's awareness of the literature itself, because they had to be involved in several type of like scientific reports that were to be grounded in the literature review. And I guess the profs were kind of like experimenting in new ways to raise the awareness level among students, because they felt that they were not performing necessarily to the best level. So what they've done, they used the rubrics, and they did some kind of action research around the rubrics. So they used it not only as an assignment exercise, but they also use it as a critical thinking exercise as well as a writing exercise. And what they've done on the first, they had kind of a cycle of five iterations of writing rubrics. So students were engaged. They had to go out and do a critical literature review. But they had to do the critical literature review by designing a rubric that would help them assess different components. So for example, they had to look for sort of like the standards, authors, introductions. They came up with guided questions about the case that they had to analyze. In terms of the methods, that was another section. They had to look at the design. They had to look, for example, at the patient, the subjects, the treatments, the outcomes. They had to also look at how it was treated in the literature, and they had to come to some kind of conclusion. So what was very interesting in that example is that the rubric itself was not only about writing a big piece at the end, a big research report. It was actually to dissect every part of the critique. And so from the beginning, from the introductions to the methods, to the discussions, to the conclusion, students had to work in group. They had to agree among themselves in terms of what standards they were going to use. And also they had to come at the end with two different products. One, they came up with a common rubric that all of the students were going to use and that the instructor were going to use to assess them. And the second piece that came out of it, they actually came up with a critique that they published in a journal using the rubrics. So you can see that in that case, the instructor were kind of creative and trying to, I won't say a killing example, but definitely they were trying to achieve multiple purposes by using the rubrics. So it wasn't just an assessment tool, it was also a critical thinking piece as well a part of the research process. And then for the last examples, because we are a distance education university, I thought it was appropriate to see an example of a literature review that Penny and Murphy, and I think some of you might be familiar, especially with Murphy, she's out of from Memorial University. And what they've done is that they actually went through several websites from university courses to look at online discussions. And they figured that a lot of times part of the online discussions, and we want students to participate sometimes, and depending on the courses that you're dealing with, you want them to produce some kind of writing pieces. However, how do you assess that? And sometimes some of you might have difficulty with that. So what they've done, they looked, and I think that they reached a saturation level where they had collected and compiled 50 rubrics that were used by several instructors across several universities, particularly in Canada. And they collected them through the internet, basically. And they were looking at what kind of criteria are the instructor using to assess online discussions. And they came up with more than 100 types of criteria to assess students. And what was really interesting about that particular survey and compilation of rubrics that they've done is that they come up basically with a variety of ways that people were assessing the writing pieces that the students were producing in the discussion forums. So I really encourage you to look into it, because we don't have time to go into it, but in the appendix of that study, they actually have guidelines if you ever struggle about how should you assess students in the online environment. So my last thought on that is that the rubrics can be used not only as assessment, but as well for different contexts, whether it's short assignments that are focused on specific concepts, skill, research reports, discussion forums, wikis. You can be as creative as you want to be.
It's Cindy again. Just a couple of words from my own experience using rubrics. First of all, in the distance education environment, the advantage, one of the advantages is consistency across tutors who are marking, using rubrics for marking purposes. So that if in the design of a course, a rubric is designed as an assessment piece for writing, then there is guideline around and credibility, accuracy, validity among across the various tutors who might be marking in a large class. Another thing, though, from the student perspective, as Karine pointed out, is the value of the rubric as structure and as feedback for distance students who don't have face-to-face kind of interactions and who are reluctant, perhaps, to phone tutors for more specific detail about what's needed in an assignment, what's recommended in an assignment. They can, in fact, also use it to shoot for what for the grade they want to get. If you're specific enough in your rubric, and a student is comfortable getting a C, then they can shoot for a C. It helps them in their time management process. If they want an A, they know what they have to do. Very practical and useful applications of the rubric. And at this stage, I think,
thanks,
Linda, do you want to start your conversation around the writing to learn process?
That we looked at in terms of assignment design are writing to learn assignments. And just before we get into the actual literature on the writing to learn assignments, I just wanted to say a bit about what the literature says we mean when we talk about writing to learn and writing to learn assignments. Writing to learn in general is a pedagogy that's rooted in social constructivist theories. And it shares a common reliance on constructivism as a theory base, and there's a heavy emphasis with those movements put on writing purpose and context. So a lot of learning theories that come out of that school of thought, writing to learn approaches are contextually flexible. In other words, they can be used across disciplines. And the key point that I want to make about writing to learn as an outgrowth of social constructivism is that the idea that students will make meaning by engaging in different forms of expressive and even poetic writing, as well as the kinds of writing that we more usually associate with academia, and that's things like analysis and critique. So that's one of the reasons that you'll see writing to learn assignments taking the shape of things like poems to authors, for example. And I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. But this meaning making is really the basis for the critical thinking, understanding concepts, which despite the distinction scholars make between writing to learn and learning to write, that critical thinking piece, as I mentioned before, is really one of the essentials that we try to achieve when you teach academic writing. Critical thinking and, of course, understanding as a means to understanding. If you could just give me the next slide there, please, Cindy. Thanks. So the writing to learn assignments have particular characteristics, and here's a few of them. For instance, writing to learn helps students to be able, because it does help students focus on meaning making, the assignments are usually low stakes. In other words, if you want students to be engaging with the material, as much anxiety around marks that you can decrease, the better, according to this approach. And because the aim is to give students practice in engaging with subject material frequently over time. The assignments are usually short and frequent. This list of characteristics is certainly not comprehensive, but these are some of the primary features of what usually characterize assignments designed to help students make meaning by writing activities. And also when we talk about writing to learn assignments in particular, here are some examples, and these are just gleaned from ones that I have used or heard of other teachers using over the years, and I'm sure you can think of more that you use in your own classes, including online activities like discussion boards. The common denominator really though is that they're designed to help students, again, use writing to make meaning, that meaning piece yet again. These are often used in combination with other learning activities such as classroom discussions or online discussions. And the next slide again, please, Cindy. So when we were preparing for the workshop and I went to the literature in preparation, I went in with the question, why should we use these kinds of assignments? Because I did know that there has been some controversy over the years. So I wanted to really look and see, do they really help students to write better, to critically think as they've been touted to over the years? And the controversy really has been going on since 1993 at least, and that was with a study that Ackerman did. And he did basically a reading of 35 studies of writing and learning. And he went in too with the question that is the connection that is often assumed between writing and learning, is that empirically in the literature? And his conclusion was that it was not, and that he argued that this assumption of that connection between writing and learning really needed to be tested. In order to do that, he traced the history of this assumption back to Vygotsky in, I believe it was 1961, and then he went on to critique the notion of writing and learning. He actually concluded or argued that that beyond writing, there were a number of other cultural influences that came into play. And I mean, he means that in the culture in the anthropological sense, for example, institution or classroom culture. And he argued that these cultural considerations could just as easily account for the skills acquisition and learning that's often attributed to writing. And more recent studies, like Carithers, seem to confirm Ackerman's view. Carithers' studies suggested that other approaches, such as giving explicit definitions of critical thinking to students, might be at least as important as writing in the development of critical thinking skills. However, the more recent literature suggests a bit more of a nuanced view of this connection. And the literature there suggests that particulars, mediating factors, as Nichols calls them, make these writing to learn assignments effective. For example, the Nichols study, he and his colleagues looked at presented two longitudinal studies, and they investigated using writing prompts, reflective writing prompts, journal prompts, over a whole term. And what they concluded was actually that, in fact, the writing to learn approaches that they looked at in particular can be effective across disciplines if mediating factors are accounted for. And a couple of the mediating factors that they identified was the ability to key the writing prompts to the development, the stage of development that the students were in particular. And then some of the literature too, the more recent literature, like the data from Carter's qualitative study, suggests that writing to learn can go beyond teaching critical thinking and subject matter and also helps students socialize into disciplinary conventions and ways of knowing, which is actually, again, an essential part, I think, of what we teach students when we teach them writing, especially if we're talking about writing across the disciplines. Okay, could I have the next slide there, please, Cindy? So some of those mediating factors that the literature identifies is, for one, the types of writing prompts that are used in these activities, particularly reflective and metacognitive prompts. Even Ackerman in his critique suggested that the kind of prompts probably were one of the mediating factors that could account for the connection that had been traditionally assigned just to writing and learning. Also, Banger Downs identified that the length of time that the prompts were used. In other words, the frequency and the frequency of the prompts and the activities that were used in the class, say, were they used across a semester or for the entire year? So that was another factor that came into play. And the developmental stage of students also seemed to matter. Again, Banger Downs in their meta-analysis of writing to learn interventions suggested that students in grades 6 and 8 were not as effective for increasing academic achievement as implementations in other grades. Their meta-analysis included these activities from grade school right up to and including higher education. And McCutcheon had similar results in her review of empirical research on children's cognitive processes as they relate to children's writing development, because she found that less developed writers have less working memory, making writing more difficult. In other words, as students master writing knowledge, such as grammar, how to organize their writing, etc., writing becomes less difficult for them. And this suggests that as students mature in their writing process, writing to learn assignments should make different demands on them. And finally, Knuckles found that that use of prompts should be withdrawn as students become more adept at reflective learning strategies. And in fact, his research found that if the approach of writing to learn assignments didn't change as students became more developed writers, that students' learning could actually be hindered by the use of the same reflective writing prompts. So although the value of writing to learn has been challenged in over the last 20 years or so, the current literature suggests that if these mediating factors are taken into account in the design of assignments, then they're valuable in teaching students about the demands and conventions of the writing in their discipline. They're valuable in teaching critical thinking in their discipline and understanding of subject matter. Okay, Cindy, back to you.
Thanks, Linda. So what we've done is talk a little bit about two different kinds of scaffolds. They work together and they work independently. And scaffolds, of course, are support structures that we provide for students as they're learning. So here's a few principles that we've extracted out of the literature review and out of the practice of coaching writers and of, I think, assessing writing in university students as well. So the recommendations, these are principles that sort of underlie recommendations that we would make. Start simple, make assignments very specific, articulate what the criteria and standards are, relate those assignments to student goals, make them relevant and engaging, and limit the information that that students are requested to use, certainly at lower levels, so that the expectations that are designed into various assignments are appropriate at the certain level. Before I go on, I might say that the workshop will allow you to explore some of this in the context of your particular course of a particular assignment. I might also suggest that working with a learning designer on the design of assignments to meet the actual outcomes is part of what we offer as a service, and I know it's offered as well in the Faculty of Business programs. So I think that this is the kind of thing we can help with if you have interest in exploring it more. Acknowledge the limits of originality. This is a principle that we also share in regards to understanding information literacy and plagiarism. Students are not going to be original, so the at least not at lower levels, and so the recommendation might be to encourage them to cite appropriately, to write appropriately for the discipline, and to design assignments so that plagiarism or tendency to plagiarism is in fact less. That means keeping the big educational goals in mind. What is it that this course is designed to do? Where is the place of this course in the context of a program or of a full degree? And remember that learning to write is a complex skill built over time. The research that shows how writing develops from children through to adults is relevant, I think, even though we might tend to dismiss the younger grades. The fact is that a lot of our students come without effective writing skills, and they need to be supported in the learning of those. And writing well takes a lifetime to accomplish, I think. And so just a hint of our strategies for assignment design.
So really sort of a summarizing a little bit what I've been mentioning. Assignment design, you know, I refer to this as my experience has been a learning designer at AU. Really, I think that across the disciplines, the various centers, all the professors are motivated to have students who understand and achieve their assignments well and eventually succeed. So what we're really talking about here, it's as you're revising your courses, as you're thinking about your courses, it's an invitation to reflect on what kind of writing you would like to read, and also to explore different ways and approaches to, for example, the writing to learn design assignments, to listed those type of pieces that you'd like to see your students produce. Again, consulting the learning support resources, the Write Set is a very good one. There's always updated resources that are based on the feedback that a lot of the profs and students have made. So this is a good place to go, the library as well. reviewing the data sources, again, as a way to structure the assignments and the cycle of revision maybe in a better way, looking at the course evaluations, gaining insights from the tutor's experience who are often on the front line is probably a good way to reflect back on what went wrong or what could be improved in assignments. Cindy mentioned it, consulting the learning designer, especially because it is about trying to see the bigger picture. You're the subject matter expert, most of you in your discipline, and sometimes it's just good to sort of have another perspective to make sure that the student's success is ensured, or at the very least facilitated. And the last piece about creating the rubrics, I think the piece about guiding the writing process for the students and as well for the tutors. I think what really this is all about is trying to make whatever is implicit very explicit to help students achieve well in their journey at Damascus and beyond.
This will be recorded so you can go back and have a look at the, or is being recorded, so you go back and have a look at the specific references, but all of the literature that we have reviewed is listed here, and much of it is very easily accessible. In fact, all of it is very easily accessible. And if you are interested in revising an assignment for improving your students' writing and want to bring that assignment to the workshop, don't hesitate to send a message to loreens@athabascau.ca and register. It is on the Monday, December 6th afternoon in Edmonton. And at this time, I think, do we have time for questions, Alice? So I think we just thank you for your attention, and if you have questions, go for it.
Cindy, I've got a few questions online, so I will start with, looks like Sandra Law. So I'll just repeat the question and pass it over to you. So she's indicated most of the information on the AU Write site seems to relate to solely textual documents, not those that rely on symbols that substitute for complete words, such as happens in mathematical writing. Is there any plan to provide support for students in mid to higher level math course so that they can write in a mathematically coherent way? There are guides as to how to write mathematically, generally follow standard grammar, but the substitution of symbols, expressions for words or conventional paragraphs may result in students having some difficulty translating their understanding of English grammar to the sphere of mathematical expression.
Thanks, Sandra. That's just a great question. I'm going to ask Linda to answer it because she's the coordinator.
Thanks, Cindy. Sandra, I'm really glad you asked that question because, first of all, I'll just mention Julie Peschke has begun a math site to support students in their math learning as well. And because there is the math site as well, that's one of the reasons that the Write site doesn't concern itself too much with as you say, those substitution of symbols and the kind of moving from writing into math learning, because Julie has a number of resources and learning approaches that she's developing on the math site. The other part of your question is really interesting too. That business of how the parallels perhaps between English grammar and translating the understanding of from one area of knowledge to another. Julie and I are actually talking right now about doing some research on that and seeing where the parallels between math speak, so to speak, and grammar speak coincide. That is just really in the beginning stages right now. It's really in the talk stages, but it'll be interesting to see where that takes us.
To check and see, is there a cross-reference, a link to the math site from the right site, so that students who are having the kinds of issues that Sandra's described, if they were to go to the right site, would they be able to automatically correct it? You know, if they were looking under, say, science writing or something, would they be able to find the resources on the right site easily, or, I mean, on the math site easily?
You know what, we don't have links to the math site right now in those areas that you talked about, but it's certainly a great idea, and I think I will look into making sure they appear in those disciplinary areas.
That's good, Linda. I was just thinking, I think I've heard you also say that you are looking for writing resources from academics in various disciplines, and that maybe there are resources around science writing that you don't currently have, but I don't know about that. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Cindy. We've been trying to beef up our writing in the disciplines area because it is so important. The conventions in the different disciplines are unique, and the people who are in those disciplines are really the best people to write some of the resources for those areas. So yeah, we are looking for people who have teaching resources that they've used effectively for writing in their disciplines that we can put in the writing in the disciplines area and share with people across the institution.
Some of your question, I know it doesn't go all the way. Alice, other questions?
Yeah, we have a question from Edna. Who did not get the distinction between the evaluation criteria and scoring strategy. So if you could address that.
Hi, Edna. This is Kareem. When I was referring to the evaluation and criteria and I think the scoring strategy, it really, this is where sort of the approaches come in terms of the instructors. Some will tend to see these like closely associated, and some will just make a clear distinction. Within the literature that I surveyed, they made a distinction where the evaluation themselves, that was where the guidelines, the factors that you consider that was important for a particular assignment. Whereas the scoring is actually the scale, like the A, the grade itself that you would put, that would be associated to the evaluation that you've developed. So really what it is the difference between stating what you think is important in the assignment. For example, is it the clarity of the argument? Is it the structure? Is it what you're looking at? Is it for for example, like a strong statement or whatever it is that you're evaluating, this is the criteria. So it is a structure, and the scoring is actually what grade, to be very crude, that you would assign to say that this is actually a good quality or of a poor quality, etc. And I hope that answers your question.
I think probably all of the above. Kareem is reporting on research that involved students in creating their own rubrics, also with instructors creating their own rubrics. So I think the point is the rubric is the tool, and the methodology for using it is pretty much up to the individual course professor.
Another question from Edna, how does she contact a learning designer?
Contact me. How about that? And I'll connect you with whoever the learning designer is who's associated with your center.
And one question from Jean. When speaking about reflective and metacognitive prompts, can you provide several examples of what you had in mind to illustrate the point?
Linda, can you report on that study that discussed the distinction between reflective and metacognitive prompts?
Okay, sure. Actually, metacognitive and reflective prompts are really sort of different varieties of the same animal, and they probably can be best understood as opposed to cognitive prompts. So, for instance, you might have a cognitive prompt that would be aimed at eliciting specific information about a lesson, for example. So you might ask the specifics. You might ask about if in a history course what was the motivating factor for the exploration of the Canadian West. So it's more content oriented. Metacognitive and reflective prompts are more aimed at eliciting reflection on the learning. So that would be asking much more general questions like, what's one thing that you don't understand and one thing that you know for sure after reading this chapter? So it not only elicits the actual material that has been learned after reading the chapter, but puts the student into a sort of metacognitive plane where they're looking not only at the material, but how they're understanding and what it is they do understand, what they don't. Another example would be, what's one thing you want to know that you want to be sure you know and understand after you do this experiment? So it starts to center students on making evaluations about what's important and what's not.
I'll just add another one that comes to mind for me. So for perhaps your writing to learn assignment is a blog or an online discussion, and a simple metacognitive prompt or reflective prompt might be something like, what makes you say that? What leads you to believe that? And so other kinds of questions like that try to get at what the student's reasons for, or help the student understand what his or her reasons are for what they've written and said. Alice, other questions? No further questions. Are there other questions? I guess that's it, Alice says. Okay. Well, thank you all for participating. We've enjoyed our conversation, and we will look forward to doing it again. Thanks.